Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, announcing the 2026 Bush Fellows. Meet the leaders thinking bigger and differently about what's possible for their communities in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. More information at bushfoundation.org.
Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We hope that you are a bit cooler today than perhaps you were over the weekend. We're glad that you are with us, whether you're listening on the radio, online, or through the Prairie Public app. Main Street begins now. This summer, many of us have looked outside hoping for blue skies only to find the horizon hidden by wildfire smoke, drifting hundreds or even thousands of miles from where the fires began. It's frustrating because there's almost nothing we can do about it. Plus, it was hot over the weekend and we couldn't control that either. But maybe the smoke and the heat are more than a weather story. Maybe it's a reminder that much of life arrives without our permission. We don't choose the weather. We don't choose to age. We don't choose to get sick. Economic downturns, we don't choose those either. And many of the decisions other people make impact our lives. We don't choose that. So what if we can't control so much of what happens around us? What do we owe ourselves in response? Is acceptance enough? Is resilience something we build? And where do meaning and purpose come from when circumstances aren't ours to choose? Well, every month we visit with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, in this segment we call Philosophical Currents. Jack, welcome back.
I am happy to be here, although like you, I have been suffering with the weather and the smoke, and it's been a rough go.
It really kind of impacts me. It really does. So instead of asking what can we control, I'd like to ask a different question as we start our conversation today. Jack, what do we owe ourselves when life is shaped by forces beyond our control? How does that change the conversation?
It is an interesting question because you are already starting a few steps down the road than maybe we would want to, because you have asked, what do we owe ourselves? And there are also concomitant questions, what do we owe other people? How are we related to other people? And to what extent we can even make those decisions for ourselves? In your introduction, you distinguished between meaning and purpose. And I think that that is a really useful way of thinking about it, because purpose is what we're hoping to achieve. It's our goal. It's our accomplishments. It's everything from I'm driving to work and my purpose is to get there on time, to I want to be a good person. I want to be a good parent. I want to make a mark on the world. These are small and big questions. But meaning is at the heart of the human animal. Meaning is what makes us different, because it imposes and interprets on the world values, good, bad, and this sense that we are contributing something worthwhile. So, for example, the meaning of the smoke from Canadian wildfires may mean nothing. It may be an accident, or it may be a punishment from God. It may mean our social and political structures are arbitrary and we're therefore really not distinct from Canadians, or it may mean that the environment is falling apart and we're looking at the beginning of the end. How we interpret the things that happen to us takes us a very long way towards figuring out how we feel about it and then what we're going to do about it.
I often hear the advice, Jack, from my family, focus on what you can control. Is that profound wisdom, or has it become, I guess, an oversimplification that ignores how difficult real life can be and how assigning meaning to things may be just as important?
Well, you're talking to a philosopher.
Yes, I am.
It's always really simplistic because, of course, what we mean by control is, I don't know, arbitrary, right? I can care about my diet and exercise every day and be a great person, and I can get hit by a truck. I can give money to a stranger to feed them and they could eat bad lettuce and get horrible diarrhea, right? Anything can happen. And that leads to an uncomfortable reality that I like to talk about to help us situate what it means to be a human being in the world. I've talked about it in class a lot, and I probably have mentioned it on the show too, which is the only thing that really exists is the moment. The Jack that existed when we started talking is a product of our imagination. The Jack that's going to exist at the end of this paragraph is a product of our imagination. Almost everything we call real, meaningful, the world, does not actually exist anywhere but in our minds. And so the way we have to start managing what we mean by control is to ask how we connect these pieces to have a sense of the whole. So, what do we mean by things we can control? Well, we don't mean our breathing, we don't mean our heartbeats, we don't mean the stuff in the air. What we may mean is our intentions. What we may mean is the very moment. So the problem is that when we say, I would like to care about the things I control, by definition, we're being arbitrary. By definition, we're thinking of some things as opposed to the other. So it all boils down to the story that we tell. Yes, I think it's very good advice in the sense that we can't control other people. We can't make people like us if they don't. We can't make someone fall in love with us. We can't make someone give us money. We can't cure someone's cancer or our own. So to wallow in these things that are beyond us can be debilitating and destructive and stop us on our larger goals, but ultimately that is no different than the rest of the world around us.
Jack, I thought about, in context of our discussion today, the heat that we experienced over the weekend, this wildfire smoke, and many, many other things, of how much control we actually have over ourselves. I've wondered about my emotions and how that causes me to react, my fears, my habits, and other things that cause me to react before maybe I've even consciously chosen how to react. How does that all impact things that happen to us?
You've asked a question that runs through the core of the history of philosophy, and there's a fault line between what we call emotions or feelings and what we call reason or logic. And historically, philosophers and psychologists and lots of other people have divided those two things, but that's not really how it works. Reason and emotions work together because we can persuade ourselves to feel one way or not feel another, right? I can watch a horror film and be scared and tell myself, this is not real, this is not real, this is not real. I can be driving down the highway and be anxious about getting a flat tire and tell myself, this is not rational, this is not rational. So on one level, we can temper or even inspire our emotions. We can convince ourselves to be afraid of people. We can convince ourselves that we're in love with people. There is that instantaneous moment of feeling. There is that instantaneous, contagious element of laughter or fear or anxiety that we get from other people, right? You know this experience, right? You're watching a blooper reel or something on YouTube, and the people in the video are laughing and you start to laugh because laughing is contagious. And there are laugh tracks. And we've all had the experience of looking across the room, someone sneezes and then we sneeze, right? There's this weird contagion about it all. And we experience that quickly and intimately as if it's our own. We also, to a large extent, can't control what we think about. If I say to you, don't think about a pink elephant, it's almost impossible not to get an image of a pink elephant without absolutely distracting ourselves.
By the way, that's the theme of Inner Tennis. If you ever want to read a sports psychology book that goes along those lines, tell the guy across the net, man, you have a great serve. And watch him not be able to serve anymore, but continue on. Yeah.
There's a great old Peanuts cartoon where Linus is talking to Lucy and Linus says to her, have you ever been aware of your tongue? It so feels so awful to be aware of your tongue. And then in the next panel, she starts to be aware of her tongue and she gets completely nauseous and she hits him, right? We can mess with people's minds that way. And so the thing that we talk about when we talk about being in control is how we respond to those feelings, how seriously we take those feelings. I'll give you as an example, let's just think about prejudice. Let's think about discrimination and racism and things like that. We have in this country been socialized to think various different things about various different groups of people. And if you were, let's say, mugged by someone from Vietnam, you may be afraid of everyone who looks Vietnamese to you. And you have to tell yourself that that fear is unjustified and unreal. It doesn't mean that you don't have the fear. It means that you have to figure out how to take the fear seriously when you need to take it seriously and dismiss it when you're not, and then to learn from the experience. Because, of course, many people have encountered hundreds, if not thousands, of Vietnamese people in their life, and only one person mugged them. So the characteristic that we call attention to when we have these feelings may be misleading. So I think you're right in that when we're talking about control, one of the biggest obstacles, as well as our most useful tool, is the emotions that pop up instantaneously in our head that feel like we are slaves to, but in fact, their information and responses to our history and all sorts of sensations that we can exploit for better or worse.
I'm enjoying my conversation, our monthly conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy from the University of North Dakota. We call the segment Philosophical Currents, and we're talking about today resilience, perhaps, dealing with things that we cannot control, or can we? Jack, I think many people equate acceptance for things that happen with maybe giving up. Can't do anything about the smoke, so I'm just going to stay in my basement until the smoke leaves us. Philosophically, then, what's the difference between acceptance, surrender, if you will, resignation, and wisdom? We could, for example, put on an appropriate mask, get outside and still do that hike. Or we can just say, forget it, I'm not going out until I can see across the street or across the subdivision.
Part of what you're talking about is measuring possible risk, in that we can look at the smoke and we can say, it's inevitable that I'm going to get sick if I'm out there, so I'm going to do something else. Or these masks tend to work, and therefore I'm going to put them on. I will trust them and I will go for the hike. But part of what someone has to say in the scenario that you've just described is, I'm a flexible human being and I can change the day to be valuable in a different way. So I was supposed to go on a hike. I wanted to be alone. I wanted to commune with nature. I wanted to find some kind of centering of myself. Well, maybe you meditate, or maybe you read a book, or maybe you watch a video of beautiful nature. Maybe you sit down and clean and focus on maintaining your hiking equipment. Maybe you do the work that you were supposed to do tomorrow today and go on the hike tomorrow. Part of what it means, again, to be a human being is that we can change our minds and we can change our attitudes. And so acceptance also involves recalibrating and reconsidering what we're going to do. Now, resignation is something different. We lose a person who is important to us. There's nothing we can do about it. And we have to resign ourselves to the fact that they're not coming back. Resigning ourselves doesn't mean we can't be unhappy. Resigning ourselves doesn't mean we can't be angry. Resigning ourselves doesn't mean we can't use this as occasion to reconsider our relationship with God. Maybe we feel God betrayed us and we feel alienated from God, or maybe we rely on God's existence to feel better about that person being in the afterlife, right? These are different options. So resignation, acceptance, what these really are invitations to rethink our choices, our actions, and how we're going to feel about them. There are horrible moments in our lives where we just have to accept and wait for it to be over, right? There's pain, there's scary medical procedures, there's a zillion different things. Sometimes we just have to get through it. And sometimes we just have to survive. And that is the ultimate sign that we can't control things. We all know the experience of driving in the middle of the winter and going into a skid, right? We can turn into the skid. We can be careful of putting our feet on the brakes, but eventually what we have to do is sit there and wait for the skid to be over and hope that we don't hit anything or end up in a ditch, because we can't control what's going to happen, and we just have to ride the ride, and we have no other choice.
When we were discussing what we might talk about today, you suggested we talk about meaning and values. So how do those become anchors when circumstances then, Jack, refuse to cooperate with our plans? And you've given many examples of how that can happen over time or in an instant.
You have to ask yourself what kind of person you want to be. What do you want to be for the people around you, and how you want to contribute to the world? So if I think of myself as a kind and empathetic person, and something happens and it makes me furious, I can take that fury out on another person. I can make someone's day horrible. I can pass on the anger. I can be someone who is hard to work with, or I can be a person who is empathetic. Years ago, I worked my way through grad school as first a bartender and then a bar manager. And one of the early days of being a bar manager, these two servers came up to me and they were complaining, and this person did this, this person did that. And I said to them, let's forget about how this happened. Let's forget about who's responsible. Let's just figure out how to fix that. And the reason why I could do that was that I was a manager. I had a leadership role. And so the value that I set on being a good manager was to be someone who could stay above the emotional fray and, you know, make lemonade out of lemons, so to speak. If I was one of those people and someone wronged me and someone was lying about me, then maybe that emotion would be very important to me, because I want to be the kind of person who stands up for themselves. I want to be the kind of person who isn't invisible, who isn't taken advantage of. So part of what we decide to be as a person is the role that we play. My best friend Gail says that my favorite word is qua. It's a Latin word, and it means in the role of. And so people say, you know, some people know me Jack qua teacher, Jack in the role of teacher. Some people know me Jack, my wife knows me Jack qua husband, Jack in the role of husband. My daughter knows me Jack qua father. And all of those things are different Jacks in some sense. And if I confuse Jack qua husband and Jack qua teacher, not only am I going to be a bad teacher, but I might get fired for the consequent actions, right? Part of what it means to have values is to ask what I think it means to be a good person in whatever role I'm in. And that's also what makes it hard when the teacher punishes our child and we want to go and rail at the teacher, or you're trying to get to customer service on Verizon Wireless and they're not answering your question or you're on hold, right? What it means to be a good person isn't simply these abstract values of kind, generous, loving, brave, courageous, whatever. It's how do we interpret those values given the circumstance that we find ourselves in? And so to be brave in the face of horrible smoke coming from Canadian wildfires isn't necessarily to say, I am brave, therefore I am going to risk emphysema by going into these wildfires. It's, I am brave, therefore I am going to assert my values and trust in myself to make decisions that are good, and going into the wildfires wouldn't be a good decision. I'm brave enough to change my mind. One of the bravest things that we can do is say, I'm wrong. I was mistaken. I need to do something differently. That's not a sign of weakness. That's not a sign of being wishy-washy. That's a sign of character, of course, when it's appropriate. And that's a decision we have to make for ourselves as well.
We're going to break for the news a little bit earlier today. I'm enjoying my discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein from the University of North Dakota. And we'll be back for more right after this. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Continuing my conversation in Philosophical Currents with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota, talking about when wildfire smoke and extreme heat and many, many other things remind us that some of the forces shaping our lives are far beyond our control. And then what should we do about all of that? Jack, I want to ask you this. Do our shoulders have to be broader today than maybe my grandparents needed to be? Because now, instantly, I know about everything that's going around, not only just on my street, but in the world. Wars and disasters and political turmoil, all of these things that maybe would have come in my newspaper, I would have read about next week. My Cardinals, I wouldn't have figured out, blew two saves they shouldn't have until maybe a week or so later when I got my copy of the sporting news. But now I know about it when it happens, and I know about it again when it happened the next day. So my question is, does modern technology make us feel responsible for more than any human being can really realistically carry?
I like where you ended the question, because I think you started with a different question than you ended with. You started by asking, are we ultimately more vulnerable, more susceptible to various different fears and anxieties than we were 150 years ago?
Because we know more, I think.
I think that's a trade-off, because on the one hand, we are more aware of the dangers of the world than we've ever been. On the other hand, we don't live in a sod hut. And on the one hand, there are new problems and complexities, and a single bad photo or video can destroy your life in the way that it wouldn't have 200 years ago. On the other hand, we have penicillin, we have tremendously quote unquote safe energy like nuclear power, but that one moment when it's not safe can destroy hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people in one moment. So I think that it's a trade-off. I think that it's the human condition is always equally vulnerable, and we are protected by wealth, we're protected by politics, we're protected by other things. But the question that you ended up with was, are we more susceptible to reacting to the world and more vulnerable to the emotions and the tensions? And in some sense, I think we are, but that's only because our scope of who is important has changed. Because, again, the people in the sod hut, they know 10, 15 people. And most people through human history never went farther than 20 miles from their home in their entire life. And so what your neighbor thinks or what your sister thinks or what your priest thinks is tremendously important. And what people 100 miles or in the other country don't think is not just unimportant, but completely unknowable. We had a very narrow experience and we had a very small community. And in many instances, we treated outsiders as horrendously as possible, often, again, going back to an earlier theme, based on skin color or religion or accent or what have you. We now live in a world in which we are tremendously interconnected. And some of the people we interact with regularly are people we will never meet in person, and people whose cultures and belief systems and expectations are profoundly different than ours. Yet their opinion means things to us. And part of America's success, this is going to sound counterintuitive, but it's important. Part of our American success is going to depend on what Iranians think of us, even when we're at war. And part of what Jack's success as a professor or as a radio guest is going to depend on what a group of people, scholars, whomever, think living in Germany or living in Tokyo or what have you. What is harder about the modern world is we are constantly bombarded by sensations and manipulations that mess with us on the neurological level, right? A person in a sod hut was not being bombarded by dopamine hits from Instagram and TikTok. Life was quieter, life was slower, life was more predictable in a variety of ways. But again, they didn't have to choose who they cared about. Now, we are being bombarded by all of these mechanisms that are trying to manipulate us on the most foundational levels. And we have to look at all of the people and we have to decide who matters to us and who doesn't. And perhaps the most difficult aspect, we have to make sure that the decision we make about who matters and who doesn't is made based on good values and just and fair and loving and open beliefs. Because we don't want to say this person doesn't matter because they're black, or this person doesn't matter because they're Iranian, or this person doesn't matter because they're whatever. We want to be able to see through that difference and make decisions about who matters and who doesn't based on the best moral information we have right now. And that's really, really hard. Let me give you an example here. We care about people who are local to us, and we feel affiliations with our, let's say, religious organizations. And so we may give a lot of money to our church, our mosque, our synagogue to help people in need. The problem with a small organization is that it only helps the people who they know. They name people, they see circumstances, and they provide money. And that's wonderful and it's important. But we have responsibilities towards people we don't know. And that's part of what government does. Charities like USAID, International Assistance, the Red Cross. We give money to big organizations or time because we say, people deserve our help even if we don't know their name. And I don't want to give my money just to the person I like or the person I'm familiar with. I want to give my money to the 100,000 people in the refugee camp. I want to give my money to the village that needs the well or polio vaccine. And so what's harder now is that people we don't know are much more real to us than people we do. And that requires that we make these decisions about how we prioritize our help, our concern, our resources, and decide, is it okay that the people we know are the only recipients of our help? Or is it okay that only people we don't know are the recipients of our help? How do we balance the fact that, to use a phrase I use all of the time that is familiar to all of our listeners, how do we balance the fact that I am my brother's keeper, but many of my brothers are people I've never met before and don't know exist?
I want to bend this conversation back to something we've talked about before, Jack, but I think it applies again in the circumstances we've outlined. I want to talk about resilience. And is there a danger believing we should always be resilient when these things that we've described in our conversation today happen to us? It's that old saying, you know, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, keep going. What's the danger there? And can that become another impossible expectation that leaves us all feeling like failures?
There is a floor to resilience that we can't go below, which is we have to get up in the morning. We have to feed ourselves. We have to get out there in the world. And folks who are suffering from grief or depression or illness, that floor is incredibly hard to meet. And we know that people give up treatment for cancer. We know that people commit suicide. We know people who don't meet that minimal standard. And sometimes we think that that's okay. If you are suffering from stage 4 cancer, you're never going to be cured. You're going to live the rest of your life in pain. Many people would suggest stopping treatment is a perfectly valid and moral way of moving on with the world. So once we meet that floor, the question allows us more choice. There are definitely times when we need to walk away. There are definitely times when we need to say, this is not going to be fixed. This person can't be helped. This job, they're not going to give me the promotion. It's time to do something else. It's time to find something else. So the resilience lies, again, not in the continually accepting the pain, the abuse, the lack of opportunity that's in front of us, but rather saying, I am not going to solve this problem. I am going to move my energy elsewhere. So what does resilience mean? Resilience means getting up in the morning, doing what we think is best for us. But resilience also means deciding who we need to sacrifice for. Because no matter how tired I am, when my daughter needs me, I plan to do everything I can to respond. And there are things that I wouldn't have the energy or the will or the emotional capacity to do for myself that I will do for my daughter in an instant, no matter how hard it is. And that's because we have this very special relationship with our children that even more than the relationship with ourselves in most instances powers us to keep moving ahead. So the classical Greeks, being a philosopher again, the classical Greeks would talk about what they called the unity of the virtues. And a virtue is a human excellence. So courage is a virtue, beauty is a virtue, truth is a virtue, moderation is a virtue. And one of the central questions that the Greeks would ask is, can you be one of these things without being all of these things? Is it possible to be courageous without being truthful? Is it possible to be truthful without being beautiful? Is it possible to be beautiful without being moderate? And this helps us understand how these different virtues supplement one another, because if my daughter needs me, then I may not have the honesty to address some question, but I'm going to have the bravery to face it anyway. Or I may not feel courageous, but I have the sense of obligation that I'm going to stand in front of her, even though I'm not courageous. These terms are fluid and contextual. So, for example, let's talk about bravery, courage for a minute. Aristotle talks about courage being extremes and deficient. So if you're extreme, you have too much courage, you're foolhardy. If you have too little courage, you're cowardly. Let's compare me as a philosophy professor to a police officer. A police officer, when the bad guys show up, has to have courage and stop the bad guys and chase the bad guys and do all these things. But when somebody says this law is unfair or unjust or you're doing something incorrectly, the police officer can fairly say, look, I have to obey my superiors. The police is like the military. I have to follow orders. There is a time and a place for questioning things, and now is not the time and place. For a philosophy professor, courage is different. If the bad guys come, I don't have to chase them and I don't have to stop them. I'll come back to that in a second. But if somebody says, this is not true, or you need to question your orders, I have an obligation to be courageous and doubt everything, because that's what the courage of a philosopher is, to take nothing for granted and to question everything, because nothing is sacred and there is nothing that can't be doubted. So the police officer has some kind of, I don't know, physical courage, where the philosopher has some kind of intellectual courage. However, I said I'd get back to this. If I am teaching in my class at UND and a gunman comes into the room, everyone expects me as the teacher to try to stop the gunman and to try to protect my students. And maybe this isn't what I signed up for, and maybe this is a different concern than someone in as a university professor would have had in the year 1700. But the fact of the matter is, the world we live in now, we expect teachers to stand in front of our students, even if our students are 25 years old. And so there is a kind of courage that I hope I never have to exercise, that if they came in and I hid under the desk and let my students deal with it, or let my students be killed and I survived, the world would condemn me as a coward for the rest of my life. And that's just the world we live in. So the term courage is contextual. It depends on the situation and it depends on social expectations, and it changes. And so ultimately, I would have to ask myself, do I want to be a courageous person? And do I want the world to think of me as courageous? And if I do, for me as a philosophy professor, that involves intellectually challenging myself and others, as I do on this show once a month, and hopefully in very rare occasions, physically protecting the people who I have a duty of care to, and my duty of care as a professor is to my students.
Jack, as we wrap up today's conversation, there's one more word that I wanted to talk about, and maybe we've already talked about it enough. You can tell me. Powerless. Are we never powerless when things happen to us?
I think we're almost always powerless when things happen to us, in the sense that most of the things that happen to us, we can't stop them from happening. What our power lies in is our intellectual ability to figure out how to stop it, and our emotional intelligence to figure out how to react to it. Because the fact of the matter is, my genetics have determined a huge proportion of whether I'm going to get sick or not. My wife came back from taking care of her mother in North Carolina, and on the plane, she had the bad luck of breathing in the wrong moment and got pneumonia. Mm. And it was horrible and it was scary. And she was in bed for 2 weeks, and it was just bad luck. And there was nothing she could have done about it. And if we had God's eye view of the world, we would have known when she could have held her breath or turned her head, and that microbe wouldn't have gotten in her lungs. But it did. And she was powerless. But what we weren't powerless to do is, the second she got really sick, go to the doctor, get an x-ray, make sure that I was home for the first week, 24 hours a day, so I could make sure she was breathing, get her all the things that she needed, and make her go to the doctor again when the antibiotics were done. And she said, I think I feel better. And I said, no, you need to get another x-ray. And it turned out she needed another cycle of antibiotics. We are not powerless in how we feel, how we react, how we respond, and how we construct our behavior to pursue the best possible of options. But what happens to us started long before it affects us, and there's nothing we can do because we can't go back in time to stop it.
He's Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and we visit monthly on a segment we call Philosophical Currents. Jack, I hope we don't have more smoke this year. I hope it becomes cooler, but I have a feeling that we're not done with either yet. But I've enjoyed this conversation.
I agree. And during the worst of the days, I really missed riding my bike on the gravel roads of the prairie. And I was pretty annoyed that I couldn't do that as often as I wanted to.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you. Voice got bass, a body like Arnold with a Denzel face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep.
And when he comes home, he's relaxed with pep. FM Kicks Band presents Jazz Night Saturday, August 1st from 5 to 9 p.m. at 4 and 4 above Side Street. The Jazz Festival follows Sunday, August 2nd from noon to 5 p.m. at Gooseberry Park. Community members of all ages are welcome. Information at fmkicksband.com.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. Bearded vultures have lived alongside humans for thousands of years. Though they're mostly found in Asia and Africa today, the vultures' ancient nests in Europe are like time capsules of a bygone era. Bearded vultures are large raptors with a 7 to 9 foot wingspan. They subsist almost entirely on bones and marrow. They raise their young in cliffside caves that are reused over generations. These dark, cool alcoves accumulate nesting material and food scraps. And while bearded vultures have vanished across much of Europe, their nests remain, like tiny, temperature-controlled museums. researchers carefully cataloged the contents of 12 historical nests in southern Spain, where the birds haven't been seen in nearly a century. They found thousands of bones, dozens of eggshells, as well as hundreds of human artifacts. The hoard included fabric scraps, part of a slingshot, and a crossbow bolt. One nest even preserved a sandal made from woven grass cord that dates back to the 13th century. The researchers say these nests offer an unexpected glimpse of what life was once like for the people and wildlife that once thrived in this region. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 27th. William Bill Heyman was a mover and a shaker in the western North Dakota cattle industry. He was born near Richardton in 1904 and began working with livestock in the late 1920s. Along with his associates, he established the Western Livestock Company in Dickinson in 1948. It grew to become the largest cattle auction in North Dakota. Heyman is remembered as an honest and trustworthy businessman. And he was known to help young ranchers when the banks wouldn't loan them any money to get started. Medora rancher Adolph Burkhart said, "We didn't have much money for livestock, so Bill furnished us with 300 Hereford cows on shares. We'd sell in the fall and split the check. Bill was real good to us." Heyman liked to tell a story about a bachelor living down near the South Dakota border. When the man asked Heyman to come and look at his hogs, Bill complied. Expecting to see hog pens, he was surprised when the guy asked him to drive a horse and wagon filled with corn. The fellow led the way on a saddle horse, and after a mile or so, the farmer started calling his hogs. They were loose on the range. "Hogs come out of every draw," Heyman had reported. "Old ones, young ones, good ones, crippled ones." With his wagon load of corn as his flute, Bill became a sort of Pied Piper, leading more than 1,000 hogs to a nearby stockyard. And Bill bought every one of those pigs, although he had no idea what to do with them. He ended up loading them into stock cars and sending them east. Then he called a Minnesota feeder to tell him he should expect a rather large shipment of hogs. "What am I going to do with them?" the buyer asked. Bill said, "I don't know. That's why you've got them." It turned out the buyer was happy with the shipment and wanted more. Bill told him, "I don't think there's any more like that in the world." Bill and his wife, Viola, raised 10 children over the years. He never did retire, but he was seriously slowed down by a stroke when he was 74. He died 6 months later on this date in 1979. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Huge majorities of Americans say corruption is a problem in politics and that it's gotten worse in recent years. Voters say one of the main drivers of corruption is President Trump.
Trump is flagrant and unembarrassed by the amount of corruption he's displaying.
A story about corruption in politics and what voters think about it on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances, all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
And that's a wrap for this Monday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, synth pop pioneer Thomas Dolby joins Main Street ahead of his August 1st performance at the Totally Tubular Festival in Newtown. He reflects on reuniting his Aliens 8 My Buick band for the first time in nearly four decades, collaborating with legends from David Bowie to George Clinton, teaching the next generation of film composers, and why he believes artificial intelligence can become a powerful creative partner rather than a threat. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.